that. Audrey was known at the home school for being the first visitor to arrive every visiting day and the last to go. She wrote to Shanti a letter every day and closed each one, "Love you more than life itself, Mom." She was planning a celebration for DeShanti's release and had rented a penthouse in Las Vegas for their first weekend together. It was a mutual attachment. I had known DeShanti a month when he was granted his first off-premises time, 4 hours with his social worker. I asked what he was going to do, and he was definite. "I'm going to Bath and Body Works to buy my mom a birthday present." There's a fine line between heroic love and willful blindness, and Audrey Malcolm has visited both sides of that line. He said he didn't even think the boy they held up really took offense because he was laughing at them through the whole thing, she told me. Cool actually tried to give the money back, and Darius snatched it out of his hand. I wanted to believe what his mother believed, but both staff and other inmates told me that DeShante was actually in the Bloods. It was easier to learn the hereditary titles of dynastic China than it was to get a handle on all the gangs in Minneapolis and how they overlapped. "I have older cousins that had their own little gang," DeShante explained. "That gang was the Fergusons," which sounded to me more like an indie band than like a sinister operation devoted to programmatic violence. "The Fergusons, their family is all Bloods," DeShanti added, "and we used to have little wars in the school hallway after lunch. Fun, fighting for real, but it was just all smiles." When I mentioned the gang to Audrey, she said that DeShanti had always had a need to be popular and pretended to be a gang member to get respect. DeShanti admitted that acting out had been gratifying for him. "I had a lot of anger after I realized I didn't have a father," he said. "I came to understand gangs as an answer to his hunger for male connection, a counterweight to his church heritage, and the intense intimacy of his relationship with his mother." He explained his gang affiliation like this. "A lot of them are your blood family, or people married to my girl cousins, and people you're not related to at all, but you just feel like you're related. Having parties, just hanging out at the park, or just joking with each other. I like that. Fighting for territory and just rivalries, that was secondary." Shortly before DeShanti was released, I went with his mother to the Emmanuel Tabernacle Church of God in Christ. We arrived as people were streaming in, the women in bell-shaped hats that matched their dresses and handbags, their stiletto-heeled shoes adorned with diamante butterflies and silk blossoms, the men in dandyish confections of suits with pleats and gathered neckties. The atmosphere was warm and friendly. I greeted DeShanti's grandmother, the first lady of the church. A man was already in the pulpit, and soon a woman got up and started singing, and before long, everyone was singing, accompanied by a Hammond organ and a drum set. Periodically, someone would say, "Praise the Lord," or, "I need you, Jesus." First-time visitors to the church were asked to stand and introduce ourselves. The first woman who spoke up said, "I am on business in the Twin Cities, and it is Sunday, and I was not going to let this blessed day go by, because without Jesus, I am nothing." A second made a similar speech that ended, "I am here today to be brought out of sin. Hallelujah." Then the microphone was passed to me. Meekly, I said, "I am here as a guest of Audrey Malcolm and Mother Forbes, and I am so moved by this congregation's faith." Everyone clapped. The bishop was performing a consecration that day, so the head of the Sunday school preached. He began by talking about how parents didn't want to see what their kids were doing wrong, and referred to 2 Samuel and 1 Corinthians as models for vigilance. "You've got to watch the company your kids is keeping," he said, And when they start in with that wrong crowd is going to bring them down, and they will do wrong. I was struck by this blaming of the wrong crowd, that somehow compromised the natural purity of the kids of this church. Then began the enumeration of evil. The people of the church must rise against the principality of homosexuality, and the modern moneylenders must be expelled from the holy places. The notion that the problems of black people in Minneapolis were the fault of gays and Jews, or bankers, reminded me of the excuses for DeShanti's three car crashes, or the notion that Darius had tricked DeShanti into malfeasance. The congregation's generosity braided with militancy and a hatred of otherness was oddly reminiscent of the gang ethos. The community saw this mix of harshness and kindness as an extension of a Christ who embodied both infinite love and the terrible verdicts of Judgment Day. I called on the Malcolms 6 months later. DeShanti was out of the home school. His grandmother came over, and the four of us had lemonade and carrot cake. "You know, as bad as I hate to say it," Audrey told me, "this was probably one of the better things that could have happened to Cool. It was overkill, but he needed a deterrent." I had heard that he still belonged to the Bloods, but with his mother in the room, he described the fine life he had imagined for himself, with a wife and an office job. It felt more like tact than deception. "Gang life is always going to be on my mind," DeShanti conceded when I later spoke with him alone. "When I'm at that desk job, it's going to be, what could I be doing right now if I was on the streets? But if you're selling drugs, you've got to keep your guard up. Sometimes you can't even trust your cousin, your mom, and I'm through with that." You don't quit a gang in some grand ceremony. You let the affiliation peter out, often with ambivalence. I wanted to believe in DeShanti's resolve, but at that stage his innocence felt like a flexible, daily decision. Loyalty turned out to be Audrey's strong suit. Unlike most interview subjects, she always expected our conversation to be a two-way street. When I finally told her I was gay, she wrote me a letter that said in part, "Thank you so much for being open and honest with us. Nothing has changed as a result of you telling us that you are gay and have a partner. You never judged us because we were black, or because Cool was locked up, or because I'm a single parent raising a son alone and living in the inner city. Some don't get a chance at love and happiness. And now I know you to have that chance, and I'm happy. I choose friends because of their hearts. I'm sure God brought us together as friends for a greater purpose." I came to love my visits with the Malcolms. DeShanti didn't quite get the white-collar job he'd talked about, but he managed to avoid serious trouble and did not return to prison. When he met a girl he really liked, he talked about her with joy. Soon enough, they were engaged. In the end, his mother had believed him into becoming who he had sometimes pretended to be. Her gift for faith proved strong enough to achieve redemption not only in the next world, but also right here in this one. I resolved to write about parents of criminals after seeing a television interview with Paul Van Houten in 2002. His daughter Leslie was one of the Manson girls, members of a quasi-commune in the 1960s who committed vicious crimes under their charismatic leader's instruction. In August 1969, Leslie stabbed grocer Rosemary LaBianca 14 times in the back. 33 years later, Paul Van Houten appeared on Larry King Live to plead for parole for his daughter. "If Leslie had never smoked her first marijuana cigarette, this would never have happened," Paul Van Houten said. "You're blaming it on marijuana?" asked an incredulous King. "With marijuana and LSD, Manson was able to maneuver these people," Paul said. King rebutted, "Millions have smoked marijuana and didn't go kill people." An expert on the program added that Leslie hadn't been on drugs when she committed the crime. I was riveted by Paul's blindness to his daughter's free choice to murder. It reminded me of the parents of deaf children who couldn't understand that those children would never use spoken language happily or fluently, or the parents of people with schizophrenia who still fantasized that their intact children were only waiting to be revealed again. Soon afterward, I read an interview with the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui, one of the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, in which she described how she became alienated from her son as he moved toward fundamentalist Islam, criticizing her for not wearing a veil, and was inspired by a cousin to refuse womanly jobs such as making his bed. Still, his mother was unprepared for seeing her son's face on TV in connection with the attacks. "How could he be involved in such a thing?" she said. "I cannot eat. I cannot sleep. I keep saying to myself, could this be? All my children, they each had their own rooms. They had pocket money. They went on vacations. I can understand if he had grown up unhappy or poor, but they had everything." The quotations bespeak a relationship between a mother who had no idea who her son had become and a son who had no wish to tell her. A young man from a middle-class family whom I met when he was serving in a juvenile prison told me he stole and crashed cars because I can. Dan Patterson never cared about the things once he had them. He had proudly traded a $300 car stereo for a pack of cigarettes. When I asked about the car's owners, he said, "What the fuck did they ever do for me?" At 17, he was on his 10th car theft arrest. He talked about despair in his interactions with his parents. "When we tried to talk, it was always like there was a glass window in front of us. One time the cops picked me up and then let me go home. My dad was just like, 'Well, go to bed. I'll talk to you later.' So I went to bed, and about a half hour later I went out the window and I took off again. And later when he asked me why I did it, I told him, 'Because you didn't try talking to me.'" When Dan appeared in court, his mother said on the stand, "This is not my son. He's not that kind of person. Why can't I just take him home?" I asked Dan when he started lying to his parents. "When they stopped noticing who I am," he said. Lionel Dahmer's book, A Father's Story, describes his relationship with his son Jeffrey, who killed 17 young men in Milwaukee between 1978 and 1991. The memoir is both a celebrity biography and a cry for expiation. Jeffrey was clearly a disturbed child from a troubled family. But most boys from troubled families do not develop a sexual obsession with murdering, dissecting, and eating their victims. Lionel wrote, "My life became an exercise in avoidance and denial. Now, when I think of those final days, I see myself in some kind of mental crouch, half expecting some sudden blow, but hoping against hope that it would never hit. It was as if I had locked my son in a soundproof booth, then drawn the curtain so that I could neither hear nor see what he had become." Such denial, to the point of dissociation, is not infrequent. In Capital Consequences, Families of the Condemned Tell Their Stories, Rachel King follows 9 families as they struggle with death sentences. She includes the story of Esther Herman, whose son Dave committed a vicious murder, then came home for Christmas, and refrained from mentioning his crime. "I had 2 very active businesses and health issues and was overseeing the care of people, and I was pretty much overburdened," Esther said. "Mother and my brother were in very bad health. It was an extremely difficult time. Dave was always a very kind person. He didn't want to overload me. In describing Dave's trial, Esther said, "We had not provided Dave with a healthy, loving environment growing up. We fought a lot, and there was a lot of tension in our home. Even so, Dave had been a good person." The psychological conundrum for the child in Dave's position is that it is extremely alienating, even traumatic, to have parents who are in denial about who you are. A mother who would think you are a very kind person and a good person, even after you've committed murder, makes you feel you have to do yet wilder, more dramatic things to be credited with agency. Parental denial, ironically, may contribute to the unspeakable crimes that it later renders invisible. As a child, Noel Marsh often saw his father, Tyrone, beating his mother, Felicity. Tyrone pushed Felicity down the stairs while she was pregnant with triplets, causing one fetus to die. Felicity's first job was to protect Noel, and her identification with him as a beleaguered victim would handicap all their future relations. She left Tyrone and married Steve Tompkins when Noel was 6. Of the 5 children she brought with her, Noel was her favorite. Steve found his new situation extremely difficult. "Anything Noel wanted, if she couldn't come up with it, then she felt like she was doing wrong," he said. Noel exploited these concerns relentlessly, trying to drive a wedge between Felicity and Steve when he thought he could profit by it. Noel's transgressions began to accumulate. The late hours, the lying, the stealing, Steve recalled. Felicity insisted that Noel couldn't be the one taking money from her purse. Steve would say, "Felicity, ain't nobody else here, baby. Why won't you wake up your eyes and see that Noel is not Noel anymore?" The situation inevitably created marital friction. Then Steve was diagnosed with pulmonary disease and was hospitalized for almost 2 months. After Steve returned home, Noel's erratic behavior escalated. Felicity recalled, "I used to ask him, 'Noel, do you hate me that much? I never would have dreamed that you would put the pressure and feelings you have on me.' He asked her to tell the police he was home when he wasn't. 'I stopped being me when I started to lie for him,' she said. Noel traces much of his pain to his deadbeat father. During one of Tyrone's infrequent visits, he asked Noel if he needed money. 'I said, yeah,' Noel told me. 'And he gave me some drugs and said, here, sell these.' Felicity said that Noel was just like Tyrone. 'It really amazes me how that bloodline is in there,' she explained. After Noel's brother was killed in a car crash, Noel's relationship with his mother deteriorated further. 'She would sit in the house all day,' Noel said. 'I would leave and not come back. We was both depressed.' By the time Noel turned 16, he had quit school. He was constantly stealing, he was dealing drugs, and his sister tipped off their parents that he was keeping guns. Thugs started calling the house late at night, threatening Felicity. It was more than she and Steve could handle. 'I had to call the police on him,' Felicity recalled. 'I think that's about the lowest, hardest thing a mother should have to do. But I knew if I really loved my son, I had to.' The police were rough during the arrest, and Noel ended up in the emergency room. But Felicity still felt that since Noel had made a name for himself resisting arrest, he was getting off light. She and Steve stood by him during his trial, and their united front influenced his sentencing. With such a good home, he seemed like a candidate for rehabilitation. He had been arrested with $3,000 in his pocket, and had said it was Steve's. Steve reluctantly let the story go unchallenged, figuring that Noel would do enough time on the gun charge. The prison time healed the silence that had set in between Noel and his mother. They didn't have much to say to each other at first, and she would often leave in tears. "He had me feeling so bad about myself," she said. Noel said, "She told me to strive for better. She don't be thinking I be listening sometimes, but I listen. I remember everything. With more than 100 pairs of stolen sneakers at home, Noel was a veritable Imelda of the ghetto. The homeschool rule was that no inmate could have more than 2 pairs of shoes, but they could swap them out. So Felicity, unable to break the habit of indulgence, would bring 2 pairs every Sunday, taking away the previous, enabling Noel to reign as fashion prince even in jail. The fathers who were missing from the lives of the boys I got to know seemed often to occupy more of their psychic energy than did other family members with whom they actually had daily interactions. No one else could substitute for the shortfall in paternal love. Even DeShante's strong grandfather and Pete's and Noel's upright stepfathers couldn't fill the aching absence in these boys. Their guilt-ridden mothers wanted to compensate for this underlying sadness, which they couldn't do. Instead, they postponed making their sons take responsibility for their actions until the government stepped in to do it for them. Yet the relationship that was so traumatic for these young men was the first thing they set out to echo. I was shocked, time and again, by how these incarcerated kids reached for emotions far beyond their effective means, a reality often reflected in their having children of their own as early as possible. These children begetting children figured that maturity would be a consequence of parenthood, rather than viewing parenthood as an expression of an already established maturity. That conceptualization of parenting is appallingly naive, but also touchingly optimistic, as though having children could provide a repair kit for damaged egos and fathomless despair. Noel had 2 children before he was locked up at 16. "I buy all the Pampers my girl needs for my son," Noel told me proudly. He had grown up hearing the repeated parable of Tyrone's neglect of this particular matter, but apparently had not processed that his own drug dealing and resultant disappearances to jails and safe houses might be even more traumatic for his new family than their not having diapers readily at hand. Although he had experienced real love from his mother and meaningful support from his stepfather, Noel had it tattooed in his mind that Pampers, drugs, and sneakers were what fathers gave their sons. Arguments about the nature or nurture origin of criminality are just as engaged as those about the origin of autism or genius. The National Institutes of Health's Maribeth Shampoo and her colleagues have shown that newborn monkeys with a gene for extreme aggression will not grow up to be aggressive if they are cross-fostered to extremely gentle mothers, even though the aggression gene is still biologically active in them. In human beings, criminal behavior has been related to a genetic irregularity associated with changed function in a particular serotonin transporter. The neuroscientist Avshalom Kaspi at Duke surveyed people with that polymorphism who had a nonviolent childhood and found that they had the usual odds of developing antisocial behavior. Among those people in his study who had that polymorphism and were beaten as children, 85% exhibited antisocial behavior. So the gene appears to confer not criminal behavior, but a vulnerability to develop such behavior under certain circumstances. While family can be a negative influence, it can also be constructive. One study concludes that a positive family environment is the major reason youth do not engage in delinquent or unhealthy behaviors. A child who feels the lure of delinquency may resist it if he has a family characterized by intimacy. In a seminal collation of studies, Jill L. Rosenbaum declared, "The parental attachment factor explains delinquency better than any other factor." Sometimes, when poor family dynamics seem to have traumatized a child, it emerges that the child has actually instigated the poor dynamics. Single mothers have more delinquent children, though it is hard to say whether that is because growing up without a father is traumatic, or because single mothers are women who made poor choices of mate and make poor choices as parents, or because these women are forced to work overtime to take care of their families financially, with the inevitable consequence that intimacy suffers. A child whose family relationships are troubled is more likely to seek out a negative peer group than a well-adjusted child is, and at that point it is hard to say whether the child has been influenced by his friends or has influenced them. Mothers often told me, "Jimmy just got in with the wrong crowd," and then I talked to other mothers who claimed that Jimmy was the wrong crowd with whom their sons had fallen in. It seemed noteworthy to me that, with a few exceptions, the criminals I met were not enjoying their own crimes. They were trapped in behavior that often made them as miserable as it made their victims. Criminality felt in many cases more like an illness than many of the illnesses I had set out to study. We cure disabled people who would prefer not to be cured, but we fail to treat some people with this condition who could recover and would like to do so. Karina Lopez came to the world in trouble and chaos. The third child of Emma Lopez, a Mexican-American teenage mother with a drug problem, Karina was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, and moved to Laredo, Texas when she was a month old. Her father was already out of the picture, and all Karina knows about him is his name. Her mother was soon pregnant by Cesar Marengo, a drug dealer fresh from prison, and headed to San Antonio where she gave birth to Karina's little sister, Angela. Whenever Cesar assaulted Emma, she would return to Minnesota with all four kids. Then he'd come to take her back to Texas. By the time Karina was 12, she had attended 13 schools. The FBI was a regular visitor to their house. Cesar was serving a 10-year federal sentence when I met Karina. "I'm glad Angela has a relationship with her father," Karina told me, "even if it's seeing him in jail. It's more than I ever had." When Cesar was incarcerated, the family's primary source of income vanished. Before his arrest, however, he had helped Emma quit drugs. She found a job as a waitress, and Karina had to take care of Angela. She resented it. At 13, she began to rebel. Most people that join gangs, it's because they have nobody who loves them, and that wasn't the problem, she said. "I had Mom, who loved me a lot. But we'd moved so much, and I never felt like I belonged anywhere, and a gang seemed like a solution." Years of poverty and disruption have made no dent in Emma's stalwart character, and she carries herself with challenging self-assurance. For many years, she ran a cleaning service by day and waited tables by night, saving to buy a house. She mistrusts you until she decides to trust you, dislikes you until she decides to like you, and has no middle ground. When Emma discovered that Karina was in a gang, she learned where its members met. At the appointed time, she broke into an abandoned house next door. "I look across, and these girls with guns are sitting in a circle," she said to me. So I cross the street, bang on the front door, and say, "Karina, you are coming home with me right now." The whole gang is there. They could kill me, but I don't care. I wasn't having my baby in no gang. "I didn't leave because of my mom, though that was a pretty weird scene," Karina said. "Gangs are pointless to me, period. But it's even more pathetic here in Minnesota. These people were riding the bus. They didn't even have money for drugs." Karina started hanging out with dealers, and the drugs were plentiful. Soon she was using regularly, high for 2 years straight every day. She gradually moved from using to helping out dealers here and there, without ever having a fixed position in their power structure. On November 22, 2002, Karina went with her aunt's boyfriend, Xavier, to pick up a horse saddle stuffed with 4 pounds of cocaine. Karina's name was not on the package. She was just helping a friend. As Xavier drove off, she saw that they were being followed. I'm snorting coke and snorting coke, and I'm fearless when I'm high. So we get on the freeway, and there are at least 10 cars behind us with the lights and everything. He's like, we're probably just speeding. I was going crazy, so we started panicking. They took a highway exit that turned out to be a dead end. So it was meant to be, Karina said. When Emma went to look for Karina, her first stop was the home of the friend to whom the package was addressed. When the police found Emma there, they connected her to the crime and arrested her. The police didn't believe a 15-year-old girl could have been operating independently at this level. Emma recalled, I said to the cops, for 10 years now I've had jobs, I've paid my taxes, I've sacrificed everything I knew how to give my kids a good life. You think I'd mess things up for them like this? She was angry for being wrongly accused, but she was mainly worried about her daughter. I'm thinking, okay, I'm in trouble for what I didn't do, and I hope I can get off, she told me. But she's in trouble for what she did do, and she's going to jail. The police apprehended the friend, who put all the blame on Karina. I told them the truth 100%, and they didn't believe me, Karina said. They said, you're doing 45 years if you don't tell us what your mom has to do with it. I was like, I guess I'll be doing 45 years. My mom didn't have shit to do with it. Emma and Karina chose a lawyer from the Yellow Pages, unaware that they could have been represented by a public defender. Meeting the lawyer's bills, Emma fell behind on her mortgage, and the bank foreclosed on the house she had worked a lifetime to buy. The attorney was able to keep Karina's trial in juvenile court. If she violated the terms of her probation, however, she would be required to serve 7 years in the state penitentiary. When she arrived at the home school, her mother's case was still pending. I didn't care about being in myself, but my mom I was so worried about. This is my fault. What is my little sister going to do? I mean, she was looking at a lot of years, and in federal. Then one rainy day in May, a duty officer at the home school told Karina to call her mother. My mom never even told me about the court date. And she's like, well, I went to court today. Karina explained, my heart dropped. She's like, it was dismissed. I started crying and laughing at the same time. I got on my knees and I thanked God, because I prayed every day for my mom's case to be dismissed. It was about 1,000 times more important than what happened to me. I was locked up and thinking, I might not even come home to my mom, and that was the sentence I couldn't face. Now, I can't wait to go home. Visiting anyone else at the home school, I felt the heavy hand of authority and the oppressive shadow of sorrow. Karina acted as though she had invited me over for fun, and her laughter bounced off the grim prison architecture. She uses foul language easily, apologizes for it charmingly, and points out the comical side of her own anguish. She was put into the homeschool's Odyssey program for substance abuse. I'm a different person, honestly. I'll always have my love for cocaine and weed, 'cause I just do. I'll miss 'em, but I won't use 'em. The biggest change was her shifting consciousness of those who'd bought the drugs she'd helped to sell. Shit, I never thought about the people who buy the little nickel. I don't meet the people that are prostituting, neglecting their kids, the people whose lives get destroyed. When I first met Karina, she rhapsodized about being in love. My boyfriend, Luis, he's been writing me every week since I've been locked up, and he went to all my courts. She met Luis Alberto Anaya when she was 14 and he was 21. I know it's illegal, but mentally I'm not a little girl. Our next visit was scheduled a few weeks later, but when I arrived at the home school, the duty officer said she couldn't see me. I assumed she had violated some rule and was on lockdown, but she was actually in shock. On October 4th, I went on my home visit, she told me later. Luis came with my mom to take me back on Sunday. I gave him a kiss on his hand, because I couldn't climb into the back where he was, and that night I prayed, "Take care of him." The next morning, when she was taking her high school equivalency, GED, tests, at an official testing site, she learned that Luis had been shot on his way to work. Karina kept her face in her hands as she told me about it. It was his first day of promotion that morning, to an office job. Serenios got him, the gang. My boyfriend was a gang member when he was 15. He was done with that. Karina's counselors were scared that she was going to relapse, but the tragedy had a galvanizing effect on her. "I'm not going to mess up my life in his name," she said. "That's disrespectful for him." A few weeks later, Karina made arrangements to finish her GED tests, which she passed. The day she left the homeschool, she had two job interviews and was offered two jobs. She remained close to Luisa's family, and her probation officer, impressed by her hard work and clean urinalyses, let Karina go to Mexico with them a few months later. The police picked up the gang members who had allegedly shot Luis, and Karina attended every day of their trial. But the evidence was insufficient to convict them. Karina moved on to a better-paying job at a bank. She was determined to buy her mother a house, to make her life a tribute to Luis, to make good. "I just want to be happy, even if I'm by myself. I want to have all the material things I need, but I want to be a respected person. I don't want to be just Karina who fucked up her life." Over the following 2 years, the girl who had never stayed in a school for more than a year stuck with her job at the bank and earned a promotion. She took some foolish risks, driving without a license, for example, but she kept off drugs and alcohol and never missed an appointment with her probation officer. A year after her release from the homeschool, she developed a relationship with a man who could accept that she had Luis's name tattooed across her back. We kept in sporadic touch, and 5 years after her release, she wrote to me in an email, "My daughter just turned 2, and I turned 22. This year was a roller coaster. I separated from her father, then got back together. My stepfather, Angela's dad, was released after 10 years and went back to jail 7 months later, so he's now looking at 25 years in prison at age 63. The government should put more money into rehabilitating criminals so that they have a chance to turn their lives around. Most of us want to, if we can just figure out how. In addition to innate predisposition, 3 risk factors wield overwhelming significance in the making of a criminal. The first is the single-parent family. More than half of all American children will spend some time as a member of a single-parent family. While 18% of American families fall below the poverty level, 43% of single-mother households do. Kids from single-parent homes are more likely to drop out of school, less likely to go to college, and more likely to abuse substances. They will work at lower-status jobs for lower pay. They tend to marry earlier and divorce earlier, and are more likely to be single parents themselves. They are also much more likely to become criminals. Jamal Carson's mother, Brichelle, had his older brother when she was 14 and Jamal a year later by a different father. Jamal grew up on the south side of Chicago, an area of tremendous gang violence. The family moved to Minnesota when he was 10. When I met him, he was 15 and on his third incarceration. Despite the word "thug" tattooed on his upper arm, he had the clumsy manner of a child who had done something silly and got caught. Rochelle was a good-looking woman with an opinion about everything. When she came to see the kids' theater project, She spontaneously made a speech to the staff and other parents about how the kids, having done made mistakes, didn't compromise their being the most talented you could find and deserving of everything we can give them. This splendid announcement notwithstanding, Jamal complained that she had not shown up for any of his court dates. Jamal acknowledged that his mother had been more supportive when he first had run-ins with the law. "I'm very thankful of my mom for keeping it real with me, and I understand where she's coming from, 'cause she's only 32 now, and she's just a child, just like me." Despite having four children, all by different men, Rochelle did seem childlike, bewildered by her responsibilities. "I kind of feel good that Jamal's going to spend his life in jail," she admitted. "Means someone else going to give him food and put a roof over his head. No way he ever going to take care of himself, I can see." She was less impressed by Jamal's accomplishments as a small-time drug dealer than he was. "It's such hard work," Jamal said with a tinge of pride. "You got to worry about people taking your life, about a junkie robbing you, shooting you, people messing with you. You gotta let him know, you can't fuck with me. It's 7 days a week, 24 hours a day." I asked whether he had contemplated other career options. "I don't know," he said. "I'll probably write. Probably do some counseling, deal with people like me. Something that ain't hard, you know?" The second risk factor, often coincident with the first, is abuse or neglect, which affects more than 3 million American children each year. John Bowlby, the original theorist of attachment, described how abused and neglected children see the world as comfortless and unpredictable, and they respond either by shrinking from it or doing battle with it, through depression and self-pity, or through aggression and delinquency. These children commit nearly twice as many crimes as others. Hua Qian's mother pushed him into the Mekong River in a tire with other escaping relatives to save his life at the time of conflict in Laos. He was granted asylum in the United States at 6. By the time he was 12, he had become active in the Asian gangs of rural Wisconsin. The following year, after keeping an 18-year-old girl in his community out all night, thereby dishonoring her, he was married to her in an illegal ceremony. Both a lover and a mother to him, she was the first person he'd ever felt close to, but he treated her badly and abandoned her with their two kids to go out partying with his friends. After repeated beatings, she left him, and his life became a downward spiral of heavy drug use. To make money, he helped run a ring of underage prostitutes, paying girls with drugs to have sex with Johns. This was the crime for which he'd been incarcerated. When I interviewed him, he was 15, and he circled obsessively, relentlessly, around his remorse for the way he had treated his wife and his longing to have contact with his children. "It's like a needle poking deeper and deeper into my heart," he said. But he had no model in his past to look to for guidance, and he seemed utterly lost. His mother had recently materialized out of the jungle, and they had spoken twice on the phone. "I don't know what to say to her," he said. His mother cried during their conversation, suggesting that he had probably forgotten her. "I didn't forget you," he said. "It's just that I don't know what it feels like to have parents." The third giant risk factor, which often accompanies the first two, is exposure to violence. One study found that children in its sample who suffered physical maltreatment, witnessed interparental violence, and encountered violence within their community were more than twice as likely to become violent delinquents as those from peaceable homes. Of course, abused children also may carry their parents' genetic predisposition toward aggression. Taking them away from their families, however, seldom helps, because the child welfare system is also associated with high rates of crime. Jess M. McDonald, of the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois, has flatly stated, "The child welfare system is a feeder system for the juvenile justice system. Ryan Nordstrom, a white 13-year-old at the home school, told me with counterfeit bravado that he had always been on the wrong side of the law. "They've put me on meds, which is why I look sweet and innocent all the time," he said. I asked about his early transgressions. "When I was 9, he said solemnly, "I smoked. It's totally illegal when you're 9. At 10, Ryan threatened a kid at school with a knife and was expelled. He was incarcerated for sexual abuse of his little sister. On a daily basis, starting when I was 11, but I didn't get charged until my mom called the police when I was 13. His sister was 6 when he started out. I wanted what I wanted, and I didn't think she'd be able to say no," he explained. Despite psychotherapy, Ryan did not seem to recognize that smoking, even underage, was in an entirely different category from his treatment of his sister, who had been hospitalized with vaginal abrasions. His parents liked S&M pornography and had played it regularly in rooms through which their children passed. They would have sex while Ryan was in the bed with them when he was 8 years old. He may have had inherent qualities that caused him to translate such unsettling experiences into crimes, but those qualities were doubtless exacerbated by the transgressions in his upbringing. Troubled kids tend to be self-destructive. David P. Farrington, professor of psychological criminology at Cambridge, notes that boys convicted as minors drank more beer, got drunk more often, and took more illicit drugs. They had started smoking earlier and were more likely to gamble. They were likely to have had sex young and with a wider variety of partners, but less likely to use contraceptives. Many of these behaviors are associated with poor impulse control, but they are also frequently expressions of low self-esteem, even self-hatred. The social critic Judith Harris has proposed that the family environment is less determinative of criminality than the larger social milieu. Unlike adults, juveniles most often commit crimes in groups. Less than 5% of early offenders act alone, and groupness often determines their criminal patterns, part of the youthful urges to fit in and impress. The likelihood of delinquency also relates to the availability of drugs and guns, the degree of poverty, the lack of attachment to one's neighborhood, and population density. Rates of female crime are higher than ever, though they still account for only about a quarter of juvenile arrests. Young women are more consistently driven to crime by traumatic experience than males are. According to one study, 75% of girls identified as juvenile delinquents by U.S. courts have been sexually abused. About two-thirds of chronic juvenile offenders are gang members. In 2009, in the United States, there were 731,000 gang members, almost half of them juveniles, belonging to more than 28,000 gangs. Tall, handsome, tough, with close-cropped hair, Krishna Mirador had a way of wearing prison clothes that made them look like fashion. His English was heavily accented and sometimes hard to understand, and he would frequently ask me, "How you say in English?" as he groped for vocabulary. Born in South Los Angeles, he told me, he had been abandoned at birth by a Latina mother whose name he never learned. He was raised by his father, Raul, who was only 18 when Krishna was born, and who was a member of Sureño's 13. The gang was the only family Krishna had ever known. When Krishna was 11, his father was deported to Guatemala, but Krishna stayed in L.A., hanging out with first one set of gangbangers, then another. One of his cousins was shot and died in his arms. "That made me snap out of it, 'cause that could have been me," he said. Raul told him to get out of L.A. He knew a woman in Minneapolis who owed him a favor, and when I met Krishna, He had been living in her house for 4 years. He'd never found out why she was in his father's debt, and he didn't want to ask. The weekend after I met Krishna at the home school, a rather beautiful Irish-American woman in her mid-40s introduced herself as Carol and said, "My son Krishna wants to be in your research project." Then Krishna came into the room. "Hey, Mom, just give him your signature," he said in unaccented English. I stood there, astonished. Carol, who looked just like him, said how worried she was about Krishna, and I said that it seemed as if he'd had a rough time after the hard childhood in Los Angeles. She looked at me as though I were slightly unhinged. "Krishna was born and raised in Duluth," she said. Krishna subsequently insisted that his father had told him he was born in Southgate, California, a Latino ghetto outside L.A. But when I met Raul a few years later, he just laughed. Krishna remains the most convincing and unabashed liar I have ever met, and his lies are usually angry ones, such as this furious evisceration of his mother. When I called him on it the next day, he said, "I guess if she says she's my mother, probably she is." Krishna's parents related to each other with such abiding antipathy that it was impossible to construe the truth from either. Each expected me to hate the other, but in spite of myself, I liked them all. "It's so complicated, Andrew," Carol said the first time we talked. "I'm just so afraid you won't be able to write it, because it's just too hard." Carol Malloy and Raul Mirador met in the late 1980s through Ananda Marga, which is sometimes called a cult, sometimes a spiritual movement, and sometimes a discipline. The group preaches unity and love, but has also been accused of weapons smuggling. One of Ananda Marga's doctrines is revolutionary marriage, originally a protest against the Indian caste system, in which people from completely different walks of life marry each other, thus breaking down bourgeois notions of class and nationality. Raul had visa problems, and Carol's marriage was failing. Raul agreed to pay for her divorce if she would marry him. "You are given points in the guru's eyes if you sought out the most difficult thing," Carol recalled. "I don't look ahead very well. In fact, I'm usually a move or two behind." So poor Krishna was born into that. They lived in Duluth with Carol's two children from her first marriage. Carol owned a bakery where she and Raul worked together. She eventually handed the business over to Ananda Marga. Raul moved them all to Guatemala when Krishna was 5. After 9 months, Carol's two older children couldn't stand it and returned to the United States to live with their father, while Carol, in her own words, chose ideology over love and has never really reconnected with those children. It took her 5 years of muddle to learn the language and the culture in Guatemala, during which time, she said, Raul became impossibly macho and bossy. He was probably always bossy, but in Duluth it was my house and my business, and it was less noticeable. She told him she was going to divorce him unless he returned to the United States with her. She was certain she could get custody of the children. Raul claims that she said, in earshot of the children, that she was ready to leave even without them, and that to spare them abandonment, he agreed to try a return to Minnesota. Krishna was 10, his sister, Ashoka, was 8, his brother, Basho, born in Guatemala, was 4. Carol and Raul took jobs teaching Latino children in the Minneapolis public school system, and they entered couples counseling. "The kids were really happy," she recalled. "When Krishna was 9, I would sit on the floor by his bed and just read and read, and then we would talk and talk. We read Don Quixote de la Mancha. We read poetry, we read stories, history. We were so close. He doesn't remember it." 9 months after their return, Carol came home one day to an empty house. Raul had taken all 3 children back to Guatemala. I thought Raoul was going to struggle with me, Carol said sadly. And if we couldn't do it, we would divorce here, work through the history, and become friends. But he was a real coward. Though Carol was furious at Raoul, she was also angry at Krishna, who was old enough to have made a choice. Krishna could never forgive his mother for having been willing to leave him behind in Guatemala. She could never forgive him for leaving her behind in the United States. For the first 2 years I knew him, Krishna maintained that he didn't remember his childhood. When I repeated this to Raoul, all he could say was, "The children are very angry at Carol." Carol served kidnapping charges on Raoul through the American embassy. She went to Guatemala and tried to negotiate a settlement. The visits were always in a locked room, at Raoul's lawyer's office, she said. There were two guards with machine guns, and I thought they were going to kill me. And the kids were so brainwashed. Carol eventually got custody in both countries. Raoul went to jail through Interpol for kidnapping. We presented the papers to Raoul's parents. When we went in, the beds were still warm. The Mirador family had re-abducted my kids. She left Guatemala in despair. 2 weeks later, Raoul's parents paid someone off, and he was released. Carol's separation from Raoul seemed necessary to her, but she paid for it with her second set of children. I was free, but I had lost everything, she said. Raoul wanted to punish me for wanting to be out of Ananda Marga, for wanting to go to grad school, for believing in myself. Many years later, Krishna wrote to me, "I know my father loves me, even though he seldom says it. And I know my mom doesn't, even though she says it all the time. I haven't seen my dad have a girlfriend since my mom. He says it's because he doesn't have time, but I know it's because she broke his heart." While Carol had her kids' pictures appearing on milk cartons as missing children, his grandparents hid Krishna with cousins in L.A. for almost a year, and he joined Sureños. His first assignment, he told me, was to steal a car. Then they gave him an Uzi with a full clip of ammunition and ordered him to take the car and go get some rivals. He said, "I came back with no bullets left. When I felt that adrenaline pumping in my heart, I was like, yeah, this is my shit. This is my drug." After 9 months, Raoul called Krishna back to Guatemala. A year later, when Krishna was 13, he came to see Carol in Minneapolis. "I don't know how it happened," she said, "except that it was Christmas, and sometimes you can get a wish through. I invited him like nothing was wrong." Krishna had a good 2-week visit, and Carol persuaded someone from Ananda Marga to negotiate for Ashoka and Krishna to come for Easter. When they arrived in Minnesota, she told them that they weren't going back. "She didn't do it because she loved us," Krishna said. "She did it because she hates my father, and it was revenge." Krishna was furious with his mother, but he liked America and didn't want to return to Guatemala. Ashoka was miserable and desperate to get home. Raoul was beside himself but couldn't enter the United States because of a warrant for his arrest. So he asked a friend to retrieve Ashoka. The day of the great escape, Ashoka was stuck at home with Carol's boyfriend. She called her father and explained in a whisper that she had no way to leave. He ordered Krishna to lure Carol's boyfriend out of the house, and as soon as they were gone, Ashoka bolted. "I helped my sister get out of the States illegally," Krishna said, "which is kind of weird, because most people are trying to get into the States illegally." Carol was devastated, but took Krishna's staying as a compliment. To Krishna, it was payback. "She wanted a son so damn bad. I'm going to show her how hard it is," he explained to me. "I had to make her life hell for a little bit." Carol, who had been a vegetarian, explained that she had started eating chicken with Krishna. She paused and held out her hands in desperation. "I'll do anything for a connection. But he doesn't, can't share. Krishna will never really engage."